Divas en Vogue performing on the tarmac of the Opa-locka Executive Airport Friday, October 19th, 7 p.m. to midnight. You can dance to Plan Beats, enjoy an open bar and sumptuous food in an elegant affair surrounded by private jets, artistic energy, and the beginning of a new era in art and design in Opa-locka. Details at olcdc.org and at 305-576-3790.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, last night's presidential debate is in the books. Which candidate was more persuasive? The use of language, of course, decides these contests. Joining us now is physicist and author Joseph Rome. He's written Language Intelligence, Lessons on Persuasion from Jesus, Shakespeare, Lincoln, and Lady Gaga. He joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome to you, Joe Rome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before discussing your book, what's your take on last night's presidential debate from a language or a rhetorical standpoint?
Well, I think the important thing on these debates is that, you know, too many people can't process a lot of numbers or facts. They're really trying to see which candidate sort of is more sure of themselves, is more confident. I thought in this case, unlike the first debate, the president understood the format well, and he was able to deliver, I thought, succinct, compelling arguments. And Romney kept thinking he was going to get time to respond that he didn't. And I think that Romney was not well prepared for this debate, much as I don't think Obama was well prepared for the first debate. And, you know, these elections, when people go into the voting booth, they're not thinking a whole long list of someone's five-point plan. You know, they're thinking two or three things. Romney, Obama, you know, Obama, has he done enough? Is he going to do better in the future? Romney, is he, understand what my life is like? Things that get connected in political debates are things that get repeated, and that's a point that I make in the book Language Intelligence. And you know, this one of the things that has broken through is this 47% comment, which was the last question of the night, and Obama understood he had the last comment, so he could say whatever he wanted, unrebutted. And I actually thought that might have been his most effective 2 minutes of the entire night, was the last 2 minutes.
As far as the importance of language intelligence in a debate, it was said that Nixon lost a debate because of a 5 o'clock shadow.
They do say that people who listened to the debate scored it for Nixon on points, but people who saw the debate, you know, obviously Kennedy was a very handsome man, and Nixon had this 5 o'clock shadow. You know, the full elements of how you deliver persuasive speeches, remarks, or tweets, or anything covers a lot of ground. In this book, I'm focused on what I think modern social science has demonstrated are the keys to being persuasive, really basic stuff, using small words, repeating yourself, using figurative language, using metaphors. What they've found is that those things stick in the memory. And what gets remembered is what is persuasive. That's really the goal. Your goal when you're in most communications is you want someone to be persuaded by what you have to say. And in general, that's going to require them to remember what you said down the line. And it was these memory tricks that the ancient bards like Homer developed for their hour and 2 hour long epic poems that got codified by the Greeks and Romans into rhetoric, things like rhyme and alliteration and puns and metaphor and irony and a whole host. There's 200 figures of speech that Shakespeare knew. I only talk about a handful in the book, but I think the most important handfuls and the ones that, as I say, modern social science has confirmed that our brains process things metaphorically, so we remember metaphors like Iron Curtain. You know, and there's a reason why popular songs use metaphors. You know, the most number one song of all time is Candle in the Wind, Elton John's remake of a song that was about Marilyn Monroe for Princess Diana. And that's a metaphor, that her life was like a candle in the wind. One of the, you know, the greatest rock and roll song of all time, voted by Rolling Stone, is Like a Rolling Stone, the Bob Dylan song. Hmm. And I talk about Lady Gaga. She also understands how metaphors work, and her two of her most popular songs, Bad Romance and Poker Face, they're also extended metaphors.
Joe Room, we have Bob Dylan's song and also the Lady Gaga song, a little bit of a cut of each. Which one would you like our audience to hear first?
Oh, Rolling. Play Dylan.
Okay. Caroline, my dear.
Dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without?
So the significance of that.
Yeah, really, what figures of speech are used in Bob Dylan's song?
Yeah, that is, I advise anybody who wants to learn how to write great songs or be more persuasive, listen to that song maybe 100 times. So your basic things, rhyme, a lot of rhyme. Repetition, how does it feel, how does it feel? And one of the reasons I like this song is what Dylan is trying to do in this song is make the listener feel what he feels, which is sort of contempt for this woman. And rhetoric was designed, the figures of speech were designed to move us emotionally. Like a Rolling Stone, of course, that is a simile, comparing this woman to a Rolling Stone. And the other thing here is that you have the irony, the fall from greatness. You know, people called her and said, beware, doll, you're bound to fall. That's sort of foreshadowing, you know. So that's foreshadowing is also a figure of speech. And the irony is here she was at the top and she looked down on all these people below her and then she became one of them. And that's irony. So what you have here is this is a textbook in how to write a song that connects emotionally and that uses simple words. That's the other thing. And I tell people think, oh, you know, Dylan was born a great lyricist and I could never do that. And one of the points I make in language intelligence is that anybody can do this because Dylan himself he wasn't born that way. You know, I'm sure he had some great innate talents, but he studied the great lyricists of all time, like Hank Williams. But he also, and this is quite interesting, this is in Dylan's autobiography, he would go to the New York Public Library, to the microfiches, and look up newspapers from the 20 years before the Civil War because he liked, quote, the language and rhetoric of the times. That's how he achieved that kind of old American earthiness and simpleness. He studied it. You know, it didn't spring out of him from nowhere. And I tell people anyone can become a more persuasive speaker, can write better tweets, can write better headlines for their blog posts, can give better speeches, can be more memorable if you study what Dylan studied, if you study what Shakespeare and Lincoln and Churchill all studied, which is the figures of speech.
So would you say that rhetoric is more or less relevant in today's culture with, as you say, the tweets and the blogs and sound bites and texting and Facebook and other social media outlets?
I really think it's more relevant. than it has ever been, even though, you know, strangely enough, it's not taught, except, you know, very briefly in schools, because there is such an overwhelming amount of information that is thrown at you that getting paid attention to and getting remembered, there's a premium on that. And tweets in particular, you know, I now have 33,000 Twitter followers at my blog, Climate Progress, and it was through my blog that I really was able to try a lot of experiments and see what worked. But getting retweeted, if you want to be retweeted, you need to write something pithy and profound and catchy. And that is precisely what rhetoric was developed for. And in fact, one of the people on the Amazon page for language intelligence said they're already getting more retweets. I mean, I would say, and I have a bunch of interesting tweets in the book, the top two tweets from 2010, and they were both figures of speech. I think that if you go to people who have a lot of Twitter followers, they oftentimes, a lot of their tweets, like LL Cool J or the mayor of Newark, Cory Booker, they're tweeting out famous quotes by people because they know that those are pithy and profound. And that's, you know, that's what rhetoric was designed to do. So a phrase like, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, that's called a chiasmus. You words repeated in reversed order. That was John F. Kennedy in his first inaugural. And, you know, though the phrases that you remember that stick in your ear are the ones that use these figures of speech.
We're speaking with Joseph Rome. He's written the book Language Intelligence, Lessons on Persuasion from Jesus, Shakespeare, Lincoln, and Lady Gaga. We're on Topical Currents. We need to take a short break. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. South Florida Theater League and 91.3 WLRN offer same-day half-price tickets at leading regional theaters and cultural organizations, including Festival Miami, Broward Stage Door Theater, Miami Acting Company, and Actors Playhouse. Information and a complete list of shows online at culturalconnection.org. Culturalconnection.org, your ticket to the cultural arts. We're funded by listeners like you and by South Florida Dental Implant Group. Dental implants can alleviate the discomfort of dentures, loss of taste, and difficulty chewing. The South Florida Dental Implant Group, dedicated to giving you the freedom to chew. Details at 1-800-541-3010. Celebrities create an aura of excitement around the 27th annual Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival, featuring premieres of top new independent films and world cinema, trendy parties, and gatherings. October 19th through November 11th. Details and tickets at fliff.com.
Critics and audiences love the Arts Center's Theater Up Close, what may be South Florida's most talked about new series. 5 and 6 show packages kick off now in the intimate Carnival Studio Theater. The series includes Pulitzer and Tony winning I Am My Own Wife, a new rock musical, Girls vs. Boys, a theatrical reinvention of The Nutcracker, and 3 comedies in a row, Zach Braff's All New People, Brothers Beckett, and The Savannah Disputation. It's the work of South Florida's finest actors and directors in Theater Up Close. Info at artscenter.org.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them, to die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep, to say we end the heartache and the 1,000 natural shocks that flesh is heir to is a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep. To sleep. Perchance to dream.
And of course, we just heard the great soliloquy from Hamlet, and that was performed by Sir Laurence Olivier. Mr. Rome, any comment? You want to talk about how Shakespeare used his figures of speech there?
Yeah, obviously one of the greatest speeches of all times, and to be or not to be, one of the most single, most repeated lines of all time. Short words, repetition, to be or not to be. What could be more elemental repetition than that? You know, and the interesting thing is Hamlet, the average word length in Hamlet is 4 letters. Mm. That's how, and yet it is considered the most sophisticated and greatest and memorable play of all time. Today, we have much to learn from Shakespeare. The other thing you have, of course, is the metaphors. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. So he's describing his life, fortune, as weapons being used against him, slings and arrows. It immediately conjures up, you can feel what he feels, which is he's under assault. You know, his father died and his mother quickly remarried his father's brother. And then Shakespeare comes up with, or to take arms against a sea of troubles. And that's another metaphor. You imagine now taking arms against a tidal wave, a sea of troubles. It's a futile effort. So even Hamlet in his own mind, when he's trying to imagine acting, he sees action as, I'm going to take arms against a sea. It's kind of a hopeless task. So Shakespeare uses metaphor to create visual images that allow the listener to connect more emotionally with the turmoil that's going on in the minds of Hamlet. And I think it is no accident that the single most quoted person in any book of quotes is Shakespeare, because he is using the figures of speech, and he has these pithy and profound expressions and sayings. And the other greatest source of quotes, of course, is the King James Bible. And interestingly, the King James Bible was written just shortly after Shakespeare wrote most of his great plays, and was written by masters of the figures of speech, people who were trained round the clock. I mean, the interesting thing, back in those days in Elizabethan England, you went to grammar school, and they called it grammar school for a reason. That's all you studied. You studied Latin grammar so that you would learn, grammatical speech, but also so that you could study the poets and learn the figures of speech. And they might spend one day on just one figure of speech, an hour studying some, Latin poet like Ovid on, let's say, alliteration. And then they might spend 7 hours going over it, having people come up with their own alliteration, like compassionate conservative. These political slogans, the ones that stick in the mind, they also use the figures of speech. Another example is Call Me Maybe. You know, you ask, why does that song stick in your head? Well, Call Me Maybe. There's rhyme and alliteration in just 3 words. So, I like to tell people this stuff works. There's a reason why certain words, phrases, and songs stick in your mind. And if you want to be more memorable, you can read Language Intelligence and learn some of the basic tricks. And then I have a lot of other sources that you can go to.
How about the art of writing newspaper headlines? You were talking about being pithy, and I guess the most famous headline of all time is Ford to City, Drop Dead.
Yeah, my father was a newspaper editor for 30 years. He ran a medium-sized newspaper in New York State, and he would write all the headlines, and I learned then that, most stories don't get read throughout. Only maybe 1 in 5 get people read past the headline. So the headline is the most important thing, because A, it might be the only thing someone reads. So you want to deliver as much message as you can in the headline. And secondly, obviously, if you could write a compelling headline, someone might actually read the story. And this is even more true in the blogosphere. I run what has become one of the most widely read climate blogs in the world, climateprogress.org, and I can see instantly whether a headline is a successful headline or not, because I'll see how often it's retweeted and how many Facebook likes it gets. And I can tell within an hour. And, you know, and after 6 years of doing this, I obviously have gotten pretty, you know, better at seeing what's going to work, what doesn't work. And I'm a big fan of the figures of speech. Ford to New York, drop dead, short words. In fact, it's all one syllable words. It's somewhat metaphorical in the sense, obviously, he isn't telling the city to drop dead, but drop dead, of course, has alliteration in it. So I think when you, again, this isn't going to be true of every single phrase or quote that you like, but I would say 80 to 90% of the ones that stick in your mind use one or more figures of speech. And that's why the great advertising slogans. I talk about a study in the book that shows that over 80% of the ad headlines use one or more figures of speech. You know, Chevy, like a rock. There's a simile. Nothing runs like a deer. That's a pun. So, you know, the great ad campaigns are based on repetition. You know, the Energizer Bunny, it keeps going and going and going and going. Or the meow mix, meow, 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 meow. you know, that's there's a reason why people use repetition. I cite another study, quite interesting. If you repeat something three times, it has 90% of the persuasion value of three different people saying it once.
Well, when we talk about, Rome, repetition, you spend quite a bit of space in the book talking about Lady Gaga. And how effective her songwriting is as far as repetition. Let's play a little cut of that and come back and talk about it.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please. Fold them, let them hit me, raise it, baby, stay with me.
I love it.
Love game, intuition, play the cards with spades to start.
And after he's been hooked, I'll play the one that's on his heart.
And what do we have there?
Well, Lady Gaga is the first performing artist to be downloaded more than a billion times on YouTube. And this particular song was viewed online more than 100 million times. So she's doing something right. It's not just the outrageous outfits. She's a very good lyricist. Poker Face is an extended metaphor. It's an extended metaphor of love as a game of poker and chance. And later verses compare love to a dice game and Russian roulette. But the main point is that Gaga in this has a poker face. The man can't read her true feelings. And on the surface, this is just on the surface, this is a very powerful song. And interestingly, I have a chapter in the book called The Figures of Seduction, where I talk about some of the figures of speech are quite sneaky and tricky. One of them is Enigma. There's a figure of speech called Enigma, which is being intentionally confusing to appear more profound than you are. And another.
And how what would be an example of that?
Well, Dylan does that a lot. Rolling Stone, you know, he's got all these Napoleon in rags and the Siamese cat and all these things that you don't quite know what they mean, so they're kind of unsettling, and you think, oh, there must be some deeper meaning behind it.
The Beatles did that as well.
The Beatles, absolutely. Songs that I Am the Walrus, even Norwegian Wood. You listen to a great song like Norwegian Wood, and you think it must mean something, but you don't know exactly what it is. And of course, American Pie, another song that has a lot of different meanings into it.
And it was way too long.
Way too long. Poker Face and is a song, and also has a lot. The Poker Face, the other thing she has is a lot of puns, a lot of double entendres, those allow her to communicate to two different audiences. So on the surface, the song is about love is a game of chance, and that's what the video is about. But underneath it, this is a song about how, and she said so publicly, the man can't read her true feelings. She has a poker face, and she's actually thinking about being with a woman when she's with this man. She says, "I'm bluffing with my muffin," which is, you know, I won't say any more than this is a perfect example of rhetoric. It allows her to communicate to two different audiences. Her younger audiences are going to hear one thing. The more older, more sophisticated audiences will hear another. And I think that's one reason why she has so many fans and she's so popular. And it's the same with Shakespeare. He is able, his plays, I think, are famous for appealing to, you know, the so-called groundlings, the people who paid very little money to stand in front, and then the more sophisticated audiences in the back. That's one of the things that, that the figures of speech do. They allow you to communicate to a very broad group of people and sometimes communicate slightly different meanings.
We're speaking with Joseph Rome. We're talking about his book, Language Intelligence, Lessons on Persuasion from Jesus, Shakespeare, Lincoln, and Lady Gaga. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We're funded by listeners like you and by Nacional Funeral Homes, offering funeral, burial, cremation, and exportation services. The death of a loved one is a time of grief and loss. Nacional Funeral Home finds a way to help everyone. Information at 305-910-4169. Did you know that Medicare's annual election period started on October 15th? Soon it will be time to make important decisions about your coverage. The state's SHINE program can help you through the enrollment period. Why not call SHINE today at 1-800-963-5337?
This month, President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney take part in the final presidential debate at Lynn University in Boca Raton. What are the issues that matter to you? We'll find out Friday, October 19th, when the Florida Roundup broadcasts live from Lynn University in advance of the debate. I'm Phil Latzman. Join me along with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin, and Florida lawmakers and top political journalists. Reserve your seat now for the Florida Roundup presidential debate special, Friday, October 19th at noon, and find out more at WLRN.org.
The Opa-locka CDC presents The Art of Transformation, a celebration of the new Opa-locka, featuring live, in concert, multi-platinum soul divas En Vogue, performing on the tarmac of the Opa-locka Executive Airport Friday, October 19th, 7 p.m. to midnight. You can dance to planned beats, enjoy an open bar and sumptuous food in an elegant affair surrounded by private jets, artistic energy, and the beginning of a new era in art and design in Opa-locka. Details at olcdc.org and at 305-576-3790.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Joseph Rome. He's written Language Intelligence. And I want to know how, with a PhD in physics and a thesis in oceanography and a climate blog, you got interested, so interested in language.
Well, it's a great question. I think the very short answer is that both of my parents were professional writers. My father was a newspaper editor. My mother was a freelancer. It's one of the reasons, actually, I got a physics degree, because I saw that writing was a tough way to make a living for both my parents. So as I pursued the physics degree, I kept up this love of language. And in particular, I actually wrote an essay on Hamlet that was published in a journal back in 1988. And that led me to write more about Hamlet and to study more Shakespeare and to see how he used the figures of speech. But it was really when I started communicating full-time myself on the blog, that on climate change, that I realized that scientists are not very good at communicating. And I like to say I'm a recovering physicist, because what I learned in school about how to communicate as a physicist, right, a scientist, is use big words, don't repeat yourself, and be as literal as possible. And that's not merely bad advice,
It's wrong.
It's the exact opposite of 25 centuries of proven wisdom. And I it took me 25 years, literally, since 1988, to sort of unlearn that and to become a better communicator. And as I said, the one great thing about blogging, the one big advantage I have had over my father, who published the newspaper every day, is I get instant feedback. I'll know within an hour if a post is going to have 10 retweets or 100 retweets, and if it's going to have 20 Facebook likes or 200 Facebook likes, and it's going to be based on the headline, because when things are happening that fast, people, you can't fool yourself into thinking everyone's reading your whole article, because that's not what's going on. They see the headline, they like it or not, it's sort of a vote thumbs up or thumbs down on the headline. Maybe they read the first sentence, and if you're good, then they'll read some other sentences. But in this fast speed world, you know, people retweet, and right when they retweet it, I tweet out my headlines automatically. So when someone gets a tweet from me, they just see the headline, and they might click on it. That's my goal, or they might retweet it. That's my other goal. But either way, the headline is what shows up in the tweet. You see most of the headline in the Facebook posted to Facebook. You see the headlines in the search engines when you search for a term like global warming. You might see a headline. So I think headlines are even more important now than they were in the newspaper business, and I sort of did my little calculation that I think 10 to 50 times as many people read my headlines as read most of my stories. So, you know, that's a chance to read, you know, some of my headlines might reach 1 million people. You know, that's pretty good, me just sitting in my basement typing away.
Right. It's pretty impressive.
Tell me, Joe Rome, have you ever heard this old radio adage? It might be before your time, but it's about repetition. It's tell them what you're going to say it, then tell them what you said.
Yeah, that is the
or an important announcement. Yeah,
you know, that's how you should write a speech and deliver any communication. Is tell them what you're going to tell them, which is foreshadow. Then tell it to them and tell them what you told them. The repetition. And I think the key point is that you know, we hear, so again, we're overloaded with information. And if I try to give you 10 numbers, you know, we lost this number of jobs and the economy went up this percent, it's just no one can remember all that. If you want to cut through all the noise, you want to do the repetition. Let me read you a quote that I like in particular, which is from Frank Luntz, who is, you know, considered to be, he's a Republican strategist, considered to be one of the savviest rhetoricians, advisors on words in the country. He said, and this was actually a PBS interview, there's a simple rule: you say it again, and 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 then again, and again, and again, and again, and about the time that you're absolutely sick of saying it is about the time that your target audience has heard it for the first time. And so that's I think distills the essence of it. If you decide, it's much better to decide what the most important message is and repeat it three times than try to push three different messages and hope people remember them.
So you spend quite a bit of time talking about the dark side of rhetoric, what you refer to as the art of seduction. Tell us about that.
Well, rhetoric can be used for good or evil, like any tool. And the great rhetoricians came up with a lot of devious tricks to allow them to say things without directly saying them. And then the 30-second history of rhetoric is that the Greeks in Athens changed from trial by magistrate to trial by jury. And you had to defend yourself in the jury. And this is different from the trials we have today. There's like 500 people in a jury or more. And basically what would happen is the complainant would speak for up to 3 hours, and then the defendant would speak for 3 hours, and then the jury would vote. And that was it. So you could say anything. So in those forums, you could hire someone to write a speech for you, That was a logographos, the first speechwriter. Or if you weren't that rich, you could pay someone to teach you some of the elements of persuasive speech. But the point is, there are a lot of things you can get away with in that format. So one of the most famous rhetorical devices is called apophysis, and that's where you negate something in order to actually say it. It's like, you know, say, I'm not going to accuse my opponent of, you know, drunkenness, or I'm not going to bring up my opponent's youthful indiscretions.
Right.
So there you go. I'm not. You say you're not going to do it, and yet you've already injected it, and that's called apophysis. It's injecting something in by negation, and certainly one of the most important points I make in the book is that when you are communicating, you have to remember that negatives don't carry a lot of weight, and you know the most famous example being when Nixon said, "I am not a crook." What do we associate with him today?
Right.
We associate the word crook because it's so strong. And George Lakoff, the great linguist, you know, wrote a whole book, Don't Think of an Elephant. If I say, don't think of an elephant, you will think of an elephant. So rhetoric has a whole bunch of these devious devices that certain people use in order to get things into the conversation. And, of course, I cite in the book, Shakespeare did use them for his seducers, Mark Antony, but especially Iago in Othello, and the amazing way that he poisons Othello's mind against Desdemona, Othello's wife, even though she is pure and honest and good, he is actually able to turn that against her with the most just devious forms of manipulation and deception.
Joe Rome, touch on antithesis, a la Lincoln. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. Why is that so effective?
Yeah, there's no question that if I were to tell you, what are the four things you should do when you're writing a speech, if you don't want to remember anything else? Short words, repetition, metaphor, and then antithesis. And antithesis is words placed in opposition to themselves. So you have, you know, with malice towards none, with charity towards all, those type of phrases. It gives your remarks a form and a balance like a scale, and it sticks in the mind, antithesis. And I think that you'll find so many of the great quotes use antithesis. And I think that Lincoln, the interesting thing about Lincoln is, you know, he portrayed himself as, you know, like this homespun log. He was born and raised in a log cabin. He didn't have the sophisticated education. But the fact of the matter is that he did, in fact, study rhetoric. He walked miles to get a couple of rhetoric books, and he worked out his speeches in his mind and in great detail. And the other thing, which is interesting, if you read Lincoln biographies, and I've read a bunch, is he was a great student of Shakespeare. He actually memorized some Shakespearean speeches, particularly one by Hamlet's uncle in Hamlet, and he certainly studied the Friends, Romans, Countrymen speech of Mark Antony, because he gave a speech in the Cooper Union which is very similar, and they both use irony. For those familiar with the Friends, Romans, Countrymen speech, Antony is speaking after Brutus is killed. Brutus, who was Caesar's friend, kills Caesar with a bunch of other people, assassinates him in the Roman Forum at the Capitol, and Antony gets permission to speak after Brutus at Caesar's funeral. And because Brutus has got so much honor and prestige, he can't directly attack Brutus. So he indirectly does it through irony by repeating, Brutus is an honorable man, so are they all honorable men. But he keeps then showing examples of how Brutus isn't honorable. So he's right, turning the word honor against Brutus. Lincoln does a very similar thing in a speech that isn't widely known today, except by Lincoln experts, but it was the Cooper Union speech, which many people think it was critical to launching him on the path to becoming president. So I'm a big fan of, if you want to become a better speaker and writer, study the great speech writers and songwriters and Shakespeare, the King James Bible, Lincoln, Churchill, that sort of those great masters. And that's what I did for the book. That's why I titled Language Intelligence, Lessons on Persuasion from Jesus, Shakespeare, Lincoln, and Lady Gaga. And I've tried to have examples from all sorts of different walks of history and life. And because a lot of rhetoric books, they're not, let's say, they're just not good reads. And I've tried very hard in this book with the Lady Gaga, with Bob Dylan, I've got Seinfeld in there in Discussions of Irony, but also the great speeches, To Be or Not to Be, I Have a Dream, some of Churchill's famous speeches.
And we'll listen to one of those when we come back. We need to take one more short break. We're speaking with physicist and author Joseph Rome. He's written Language Intelligence, Lessons on Persuasion from Jesus, Shakespeare, Lincoln, and Lady Gaga.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on South Florida's NPR news station 91.3 WLRN and NPR for the Florida Keys 91.5 WKWM. For the past 2 weeks, WLRN's Kenny Malone and the Miami Herald's Patrick Farrell have been traveling our swing state to capture the voices of the powerful Florida voter. Join them Wednesday at 6 p.m. at Books and Books in Coral Gables as they discuss their dispatches from the swing state and follow their journey online at WLRN.org.
Cami Music presents the first ever concert of the Moscow Stratensky Monastery Choir in Florida with a program of rare Russian sacred chants, popular folk songs, and 20th century romances. Having performed at the Vatican and Notre Dame de Paris, the choir is coming to the Adrian Arsht Center on Wednesday, October 17th at 8 p.m. The New York Times describes their sound as a luminous blend characteristic of Russian choral tradition. Tickets at arshtcenter.org. Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Thursday's Topical Currents. We begin with a look at the negotiations behind the Private Commission on Presidential Debates. The contracts between Democratic and Republican parties exclude third parties, prohibit direct questions from candidate to candidate, and don't allow challenges for future debates. And more, Linda Gassenheimer with pastry chef Hetty Goldsmith of Miami's Michael's Genuine Food and Drink. She's written Baking Out Loud. Tune in Thursday at 1 o'clock for Topical Currents.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is no time for generalities, and I will venture to be precise. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow. This is certainly not the liberated Europe we fought to build up, nor is it one which contains the essentials of permanent peace.
Pretty effective for someone with such a speech impediment, huh, Joe Rowe?
Yeah, Churchill studied rhetoric from a very young age. He actually wrote an unpublished essay that people can find online called The Scaffolding of Rhetoric. And that's a great metaphor title because the point of rhetoric is not to appear as if you're doing using a systematic approach to being persuasive, but to sound natural as Churchill does. So the scaffolding, as with building a building, you remove the scaffolding at the end and you just have the beautiful building. And this speech, this famous speech, Churchill introduced a metaphor, the Iron Curtain, that lasted, until it was brought down, in the 80s and 90s. Pretty impressive for one guy to come up with a phrase that probably got repeated millions of times over the next five decades, a very visual image, even though it was a metaphor, of this, Iron Curtain descending. You can sort of see these countries being closed off, walled off, almost comparing them to a prison. Really, really powerful stuff, and yet just two words, Iron Curtain.
I remember a speech of Hitler's during the height of the Blitz, of Churchill's, where he called Hitler a bloodthirsty gutter snipe, and it just stuck in my head so much. It was so graphic.
Churchill, you know, there's a series of speeches that are considered some of the greatest speeches of all times. You know, his famous, "We shall fight in France, we shall fight on the seas and oceans, we shall fight in the air, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we can shall fight in the fields and in the streets." You can really, really feel that. Churchill said that every, quote, "every speech is a rhymeless, meterless verse," which means he really understood what he was trying to do there. That's actually a figure of speech. When you repeat the openings, we shall fight," that's called anaphora, and it's used really motivationally to get an audience revved up. The reverse of it is when you repeat the phrase at the end. That's actually called epistrophe. The names aren't that important, but that's where you repeat the words at the end, like "the government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth," that's Gettysburg Address. And when you repeat the words at the end, you're not revving people up. It's actually more narrative or instructional. And the point of the figures is that not only did people like Shakespeare and the King James Bible translators know 200 figures of speech, but they knew the different places that you would use them most effectively, because that was the point. The point was to mirror the way real people speak, the point is to be, again, persuasive and memorable, that's what the masters of the figures know how to do. Now, I called the book Language Intelligence. It took me many years to realize not to put the word rhetoric in the title, because people have this misperception of rhetoric, that it's somehow highfalutin talk, you know, $50 words, and it's not the way real people speak. And that's the exact opposite of the truth.
So this begs the question, if rhetoric is so essential, why is it no longer taught?
Well, it's a very good question. I think that partly it's because of the Enlightenment and the view that we were going to try to build a society and an educational system around logic and the facts. And so that's what science is. And I studied science, as I said. We learned a scientific method. We learned a scientific way of speaking. And that was what Plato's dream was. Plato didn't like rhetoric because he thought it could be used to convince people of the weaker cause. In other words, it could be used to convince people against the facts. So that's one of the main reasons it isn't taught anymore. It just kind of fell by the wayside as science-based education, the Enlightenment, swept over the land. And it got relegated to Latin class, which was a mistake. People, the Elizabethans didn't study Latin to learn Latin per se. They studied Latin so they could read the Latin poets and learn rhetoric. And I think the mistake a lot of people made, you know, in the last century is teaching Latin for its own sake. So, but the point is, and you know, just as, to conclude, the point is there is a systematic way to be more persuasive and memorable. And anybody can learn the basics of it. They can get Language Intelligence. They can read the King James Bible. They can the works of Shakespeare. Download the great speeches on their iPod. My friend Van Jones, the great progressive speaker, he would listen to speeches of Martin Luther King and Churchill and Ronald Reagan over and over and over again on his iPod, like some people listen to jazz. And then he got their rhythm and their tricks that way.
We just have about a minute and a half left, so I wanted to ask you, could you tell us more about your blog, The Climate Progress, and your website?
Sure. I'm write for the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and I write, I'm a physicist by training. I worked for 5 years at the U.S. Department of Energy, my brother lost his home in Hurricane Katrina, and he said, you know, should I rebuild? So I started talking to climate scientists about that, and I learned that the situation was more dire than I thought, and that climate scientists weren't doing a good job communicating. So I stopped the clean energy consulting, which I was doing, and I started communicating and began wrote a book, and then this blog. And what I try to do in the blog is communicate climate science, communicate the solutions, clean energy, energy efficiency, solar, wind, and the like, and then talk about the politics, because this is a politicized issue. And I try to do it, you know, in a fashion, you know, that is readable, humor, irony, metaphor, because although it's a serious subject, no one could keep reading it. You know, it's true of any serious subject. You've got to bring something interesting to it if you want people to keep coming back.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. Physicist and author Joseph Rome, his book is Language Intelligence, Lessons on Persuasion from Jesus, Shakespeare, Lincoln, and Lady Gaga. Thank you, Joe Rome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to the program. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Thanks to colleague Michael Stock for his important contribution, and Paul Leary gives production assistance. We have author and book links, such as today's, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like. Also find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our new website, that's WLRN.org. And tomorrow's program begins with how the current presidential debate process has evolved. The bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates is actually corporate-driven and excludes third-party candidates. And to the calendar, on this day in 1920, 92 years ago, the birth of actor Montgomery Clift in Omaha. He died of a heart attack at age 45. A Place in the Sun, From Here to Eternity, and Judgment at Nuremberg. Also on this day in 1931, 81 years ago, gangster Al Capone gets 11 years at Alcatraz for tax evasion. It was the only charge that stuck. And one more before we head for North Beach. On this day in 1989, 23 years ago, a deadly San Andreas Fault earthquake strikes San Francisco. 7.1 on the Richter scale. Millions witnessed it live on TV during a World Series broadcast. 63 died. And we leave with a thought from Alphonse Gabriel Capone, whose business card said he was a furniture salesman. Quote, "I am going to St. Petersburg, Florida tomorrow. Let the worthy citizens of Chicago get their liquor the best they can. I'm sick of the job. It's a thankless one and full of grief." This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.3 W.